Council, please come to council table.
May I please report, this is Thomas C. Earl, which is in our residential petition.
Let me say, council, that we have this kind of request very often, and if we made an exception for you, we'd be rearranging arguments almost every week. You can refer to them in your brief or whatever you want to, but...
I understand completely, Your Honor.
Okay.
In this particular case, Your Honor, I would submit that as presented in the trial court, it was an extremely simple case. Sagebrush Sales Company, New Mexico Corporation, which is a lumber distributor, brought suit upon causes of action sounding in contract, debt, and fraud, against four entities. Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated as a corporation, Richard C. Strauss, Crawford Strauss Properties, a Texas general partnership, and Strauss Investments Incorporated as a corporation. In its pleadings, Sagebrush alleged that, in fact, Richard C. Strauss had operated all of the other defendant entities as a sole proprietorship, in which he assumed their names as his trade names, and that, in fact, in all of the dealings with Sagebrush Sales Company, Sagebrush Sales Company was, in fact, dealing with Richard C. Strauss. It alleged that the credit, which was sued upon based upon a January 1974 purchase order, was extended in reliance upon the finances and the inducement of Richard C. Strauss by when Sagebrush had requested financial data and to know whom it was dealing with in the spring of 1973. It was supplied with his personal financial references and his personal financial statement, which was styled Richard C. Strauss doing business as Crawford Strauss Properties. It also alleged that, in fact, Richard C. Strauss, while doing business under this name as a sole proprietorship, intended to defraud Sagebrush by later claiming, as he in fact did in his sworn pleadings, that Sagebrush had dealt really with Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated as a corporation. The evidence in this case, all of which was presented by the plaintiff, I would submit, would have supported an instructed verdict in favor of the plaintiff. The Court of Civil Appeals had before it 11 points of error, which, alas, the Court of Civil Appeals did not define the nature of those points of error, and so we must look at the trial record, really, to figure out what the points of error were. The only thing that was preserved in the trial court were the shotgun, joint, no evidence, and insufficient evidence objections that were made by all of the defendants together, speaking as a unit in the trial court, in which they have made the same objections to all 11 plaintiff's special issues. We don't really know whether it was in the objections to the charge or in the motion for instructed verdict where they might have preserved the no evidence objections, because the appellants in the Court of Civil Appeals never disclosed that, in spite of the fact that the appellee pointed this out to the Court of Civil Appeals. But at any rate, the Court of Civil Appeals at most had before it, with respect to the instant respondents, 5 no evidence points. The scope of review that is authorized under a no evidence point, I think, has long been well defined and narrowly circumscribed by innumerable decisions of this court. It requires the reviewing court to look at the record, the entire record, in the light most favorable to the verdict, and to consider only the evidence and the reasonable inferences which support the verdict and disregard all else. I would respectfully submit to this court that the Court of Civil Appeals apparently applied the converse of that rule. In this case, we have the testimony of 3 witnesses, essentially on the liability facts. The testimony of Mr. Jack Cheshire, who was the credit manager for Sagebrush Sales Company. We have the testimony of Richard E. Scammell, who was the purchasing agent and coordinator of apartment house projects for Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated. And we have the testimony of Richard C. Strauss by deposition. Now, for some reason, again, the Court of Civil Appeals made a distinction between the live testimony and the deposition testimony. I was not aware that in law there was any distinction between the two. In this case, the evidence showed that in the spring of 1973, Sagebrush Sales Company was contacted about extending a line of credit for a large project for a firm in Dallas, Texas. The evidence clearly shows that at that point, Sagebrush didn't really pay any attention to what name was given to it. Mr. Cheshire testified that he heard a number of names around the same time, but what name was given to him first, he didn't place any significance on because, in fact, he hadn't dealt with any of these people before. And in fact, what he really wanted to know was who was going to pay the bill and how financially responsible that person was. He requested a financial statement and financial references. Raymond Scammell, the man he spoke to who worked for Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated. Scammell testified that Mr. Strauss owned the corporation for which he worked. But he also said that he really didn't know the backup, the legal backup, of any of these names. Crawford Strauss Properties, Crawford Strauss Properties, a Texas General Partnership, Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated, Strauss Investments Incorporated. What he did say was that they all pertained to Richard C. Strauss since A. Gale Crawford had left his partnership with Mr. Strauss. His testimony, when it's read in its context, clearly indicated that it was his custom and practice every time a creditor asked him for such financial data, he always sent the personal financial data of Richard C. Strauss. Prior to Mr. Crawford leaving the partnership, he used to send Mr. Crawford's also. But at the time that this occurred, the only reason why Mr. Strauss's financial statement was sent was because, well, I always did it, and there was no financial statement or financial references in the name of Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated. The particular financial statement of Mr. Strauss was introduced in the evidence, and it is Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 1. Now, we know that in this case, plaintiff alleged alter ego on the grounds that these other entities, these other defendants besides Mr. Strauss, were not, in fact, separate entities. They were all operated as a single business enterprise with Mr. Strauss. Their identities and their affairs had been so intermixed that, in fact, literally, they were another self of Richard C. Strauss. Okay, what does this financial statement show? Well, right up on the top, it says cash in banks, company accounts, $200,000, which Mr. Strauss claims as his own personal asset. It also shows a net worth of over $5.5 million. Very significantly, on the third page of this financial statement, in a list of probably 15 different commercial real estate sections that Mr. Strauss owns, it shows property that he claims personal ownership of in Memphis, Tennessee, Tampa, Florida, and San Antonio, Texas. The testimony shows that the first purchase order came to Sagebrush in early 1970, around June of 1973, and it was to send some lumber to Memphis, Tennessee. The purchase order was in the name Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated. It shipped the merchandise, But as Mr. Cheshire testified, since he got the personal references and financial statement of Mr. Strauss, he set up the account in the style Crawford Strauss to denote Richard C. Strauss. He mailed the invoice to Crawford Strauss, and lo and behold, as he testified, the payment came back, not from in the name Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated, the payment came back from Richard C. Strauss doing business as Strauss Investments. There were, in fact, in this case, four check stubs that were admitted into evidence and a copy of one check. Mr. Cheshire testified that they didn't save any of the materials that they received before or after January 1974, which is the date of the purchase order we sued on. But he did testify that the checks and the check stubs that he received, that we had copies of after that date, were essentially the same as those received before. Now, if you look at these check stubs and that check, you will see the only reasonable inference is that Mr. Strauss, under his DBA, Strauss Investments, had accounts set up to pay the bills that accrued in the name Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated. He had these four accounts set up to pay in the name Richard C. Strauss, doing business as Strauss Investments. It wasn't something where a man haphazardly wrote a check out of his own bank account to pay a corporate bill. It wasn't a situation where you could say that there was a loan, because no one ever testified in this case that Mr. Strauss loaned Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated a nickel. In this case, we go on. And again, I might add, the Court of Civil Appeals, for some reason, disregarded this evidence. Now, I don't know why. There certainly weren't any objections in the trial court as to its admissibility. And I know what the points of error were before that court. But alas, it was not considered. We go on. On July 24th, it's true. That was the first date that anyone from Sagebrush Sales Company actually talked to Mr. Strauss. And the testimony showed without any rebuttal that on that date, Mr. Strauss said, "I owe the money, and if you won't agree to take less than what I owe you, I will be forced to take personal bankruptcy." Now, I don't know, maybe the Court of Civil Appeals believed that this was an oral confession which had not led to physical evidence and therefore was inadmissible. But being like the other petitioner's attorney, I practice here and down the court, and I believe that rule applies down there, but it doesn't apply here. And certainly Mr. Strauss admitting that he owed the money and being there, sitting in the courtroom when Mr. Cheshire testified in this manner, and not taking the opportunity to get on that witness stand and say, "I never said anything like that." I would submit that his admission on July 24th is awfully strong evidence of what he intended back in the spring of 1973, and it also is awfully strong evidence of the fact that Mr. Scammell was authorized to send this financial statement and this these financial references to, as Mr. Scammell said, to establish credit with our firm. In this case, we have exhibits here which show that, lo and behold, Mr. Strauss was using the name Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated as a synonym for his own name. On July 24th, it's been admitted into evidence, there was a summary of the debts of in the name Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated that were owed to Sagebrush. And on that debt, the testimony shows that Mr. Strauss admitted that was his debt. And he didn't make any claim on that date that this was a corporate debt. Later, that In the evidence, it shows that late in August, Mr. Strauss mailed a letter to Sagebrush wherein he admitted that in the name Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated that there was $36,864 owing to Sagebrush. The record also shows a copy of a check, again on one of these accounts that obviously had long been set up. There's Mr. Strauss paying the $36,864 in the name Strauss Investments. In an exhibit which was admitted into evidence, the defendants offered this exhibit into evidence. On the second page, paragraph 8, at two places, we find that the instrument speaks, and the correction was made by Mr. Strauss's attorneys in his presence. We find the instrument speaks of the debt against Richard C. Strauss, comma, Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated, comma, the present owner of the property. It's referring to a piece of property in San Antonio, Texas, the Way 3 Apartments. And lo and behold, if we go back and look on plaintiff's exhibit number 2, we see that the only reasonable inference can be that that property was in fact owned by Richard C. Strauss. Now, I would submit to this court that in this case, whether the court goes on the basis of Giora versus Navarro or on the basis of the H.E. Butts case, which I've cited in my brief, and I recognized in citing that case that the Butts case has a little unusual history, which is not shown completely in either Shepard's or the writ of error tables, but the Butts case was a case in which this court granted the application for writ of error and then dismissed the application with the notation NRE on the grounds that the cause had become moot. But at any rate, in this case, I would submit that the evidence and all of the reasonable inferences from the evidence that can be drawn in view of the fact that the defendant never offered a single check, even in the name Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated, much less showing that the corporation had ever paid a nickel on this debt. I would submit from all of the evidence and the fact that the defendants never attempted to offer any rebuttal whatsoever, the only reasonable inferences in this case that can be drawn are those which support the jury's verdict. In the Court of Civil Appeals, upon these five no evidence points, well, I should say this. In the trial court, all four defendants were served with process and answered by and through Richard C. Strauss. He was also served with process under the name of Strauss Investments. He appeared and answered in that name. Throughout the trial court, the defendants appeared in unified pleadings. Throughout their objections to the charge, they objected as a unit. In their motion for judgment NOV, they moved for judgment NOV as a unit. All four of the defendants filed an appeal to the Court of Civil Appeals. All four defendants appeared in a joint brief. All four defendants jointly urged their 11 points of error. And I would submit there is one statement in the, I think, which demonstrates the approach the Court of Civil Appeals took to this case. In the opinion of the Court of Civil Appeals, they say that Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated does not deny it owes this debt. It merely cannot pay it. Well, I would submit that the only place in the entire record that is before this court where there is anything to support that is in the appellant's supplementary post-submission brief. In fact, Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated as a corporation fought to the bloody end until they realized, hey, somebody's got to be tossed to the dogs. And it was not until after oral argument that Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated suddenly became persona non grata in this unit. With respect to the five no evidence points, the Court of Civil Appeals held as a matter of law that that Sagebrush was put on notice. It was dealing with the corporation, solely with the corporation, Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated. Now, I would submit that it's well established that facts may not be deemed contrary to the verdict. I would submit that the evidence of Mr. Strauss paying the bill, admitting he owed the bill, the sending of the financial statement and the references and everything else, and the fact that Mr. Cheshire testified that as far as he was concerned, he was always dealing solely with Richard C. Strauss, no matter what the assumed name was that he assumed, that he took in any particular transaction. And in this case, this court can see without dispute that Mr. Strauss had one load of assumed names. We also see in this case evidence that apparently these corporations and Mr. Strauss all used the same stationery. We have a copy of a letter which shows that the same R.E. Scammell, under the name of Mr. Scammell, is writing to Sagebrush inquiring about materials which were purchase ordered in the name Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated on a letterhead that shows Strauss Investments, Crawford Strauss Properties, Crawford Strauss, even a Crawford Strauss Management Company. It appears from this record that Mr. Strauss had the habit of using the DBAs that would normally have been expected to have been utilized by corporations which he had set up. But apparently, these corporations were nothing more than a pure and simple legal fiction. The only basis upon which we can say that Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated, that there was a corporation under the name Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated, or a corporation under the name Strauss Investments Incorporated, is under the auspices of Rule 52. And the fact that the plaintiff alleged that these were both his assumed names and the names of corporations. There was not a shred of evidence that was introduced to show that any of these had a separate existence. We do know from the testimony that every one of them resided at the same address. We do know from the evidence that every one of them used the same telephone number. We do know that Mr. Scammell testified that he worked for Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated, and we do know that Mr. Scammell testified that he worked for Strauss Investments, Inc. We do know that Mr. Scammell said that when the invoices came in, they would either come in through him or his secretary or through his secretary and would be processed by the accounting section of Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated. He didn't know who paid the bills, and he didn't know if any of them were paid. But the record shows that they were paid, and the record shows who paid them. I would submit to this court that when the evidence in the instant case is compared with the evidence that was presented in Tigret versus Pointer, a case decided by the Dallas Court of Civil Appeals, the trial court found in favor of the defendant, found as a matter of law there was no alter ego, and the Dallas Court of Civil Appeals reversed the trial court and held as a matter of law that alter ego had been established as a matter of law, I would submit that when the evidence in this case is compared with Tigret, I nail the hide to the barn door one heck of a load better than anybody did in Tigret. In this case, again, in Tigret, the defendants offered some testimony. In this case, there was none. The special issues that were submitted, the court held, as I said, under these five no evidence points, that in fact the jury there was no support in the evidence for any one of the seven liability special issues, which the jury had answered affirmatively. Now, I would respectfully submit as a regular plaintiff's lawyer that I have never found a Dallas jury that's going to give me a plaintiff's verdict on no evidence. I might also submit that there were no widows or orphans in this case. There was a New Mexico corporation, and the witness inspired a great deal of sympathy when he admitted that in the previous year he had made well over $1 million. In this case, the jury was asked, do you find that the affairs of Crawford Strauss Properties, Texas General Partnership, Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated, Strauss Investments, and Strauss Investments Incorporated were indistinguishable from the affairs of Richard C. Strauss and that he controlled each? The jury answered, yes. And I would submit, Your Honors, that if the jury had answered no, such an answer would have been against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence, because there was no evidence of anything else but all of these entities operating together. The jury was asked, do you find that Richard E. Scammell was authorized by Richard C. Strauss to furnish Sagebrush Sales Company with a copy of his, Richard C. Strauss's, DBA Crawford Strauss Properties, financial statement in the spring of 1973? The jury answered, yes. All right, now within the Court of Civil Appeals said there was no evidence that Mr. Scammell had ever been authorized. Well, if he hadn't been authorized, then why was Mr. Strauss paying the bill and admitting he owed the money? Well, it just doesn't figure. Mr. Strauss, by paying the bill, admitted he had authorized Mr. Scammell. And certainly, Mr. Strauss never got on the witness stand and said that he wasn't authorized. The other thing is that really what we're talking about here is the finances of Richard C. Strauss. The next question goes on to say, what was Mr. Strauss's intent in furnishing this? It was to get Sagebrush to extend its credit. And the jury found that he did, in fact, that Sagebrush relied. The evidence, the next issues asked, did he represent himself as Crawford Strauss Properties and Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated? And the jury found he did. Whether or not this court wants to look at Rule 93-0 or not really doesn't make any difference, because in this case, the jury was asked and the jury found that the name Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated was his assumed name. Special issues numbers 2, 6, and 8 was submitted over only these no evidence and insufficient evidence objections. The defendant never claimed at that point that they didn't know that what Sagebrush was trying was a case in which their position was that Richard C. Strauss and Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated were synonyms for one and the same person, Richard C. Strauss. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Before we we'll follow. We'll take a brief recess. Please be seated. We'll hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Jackson, will present argument to the respondent.
May it please the court. I'd like to begin by stating my analysis of the case, if I could, just briefly. Sagebrush Sales Company, the plaintiff, was represented in these transactions by its credit manager, a Mr. Cheshire, who was the only live witness to testify. Mr. Cheshire was a man of some 20 years experience in the credit business, and Sagebrush was a large company. The evidence shows that it had some $34 million of sales during the year in question. It entered into a series of contracts with a corporation and with a corporation only, Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated. The contracts were to sell that corporation about $1 million worth of lumber. Now these contracts were purchase orders on the form of Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated, and the plaintiff suit is under one of those contracts, one of those purchase orders, which it describes as a contract. Mr. Cheshire testified at the trial that he knew he was making a contract with a corporation. I've quoted his testimony on page 17 of my application for writ of error. Question, did you notice that the purchase orders all came from the corporation? Answer, yes. Question, did you notice that the company accepted the purchase orders from the corporation? Answer, yes. Now, he also testified, Mr. Cheshire did, that he and his boss, the president of Sagebrush, considered asking for a guarantee of the corporate obligation from Mr. Richard C. Strauss, the president of Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated. He testified that that subject was discussed with some of the representatives of Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated, and they never asked for, and certainly never got, a guarantee. That was in 1973. A year or so went by, and the corporation got itself into financial trouble.
Counsel,
in July 19th...
Excuse me just a second. With regard to that statement you just made about considering asking for Strauss's personal guarantee, at what period in this ball game was that? Was that before or after credit had been extended?
I take it that it was both, but the time is vague. But they continued to extend credit without a guarantee. Then, as I say, the corporation got into financial trouble. In July of 1974, they entered into an elaborate series of contracts for the corporation to pay the indebtedness. They recognized in those contracts that there was, about the contract, they recognized in the settlement agreements that the purchase order contract was with the corporation and with the corporation only. They did not seek to place any personal liability on that, on any of the indebtedness with Richard Strauss. Then in September of 74, they had yet another settlement series where again they recognized in the written agreements that the obligation was the obligation of the corporation only, and they still didn't seek a guarantee. So what this case, in my view, comes down to is that the corporation has not been able to pay about $180,000, and they have gone into court to try to find some theory upon which they could have, on which they can get this guarantee of the corporate obligations that they did not seek and did not obtain when they were contracting with the corporation. And I might add this, even in the courthouse, this matter of placing individual liability upon the owner, the president of the corporation, Mr. Strauss, came in an amended pleading. The case was originally filed against the corporation owner. The original petition alleged that they had a contract and the contract was breached with the corporation owner, Crawford Strauss Incorporated. So as I say, it seems to me that they are seeking theories upon which to get a guarantee that they could easily have gotten for themselves.
Remember, these purchase orders were all in the name of the corporation, as I understand it.
Yes.
Now, when they would send you the lumber, they'd send you a bill for the lumber they just sold you?
They would send the bill at some time, or whether it was...
And when would they make the bill to?
The bill, as I recall, are on a computer-looking thing, and they say Crawford Strauss. They don't say Crawford Strauss Properties, they don't say Incorporated, they say Crawford Strauss. There's a stack of bills in the testimony there.
Did the corporation protest that?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think there was any occasion to think that the company was, that Sagebrush was contending anything other than, that they were sending the bill to the corporation. I don't think that the corporation would have to protest or did not protest that something was not sent to it in its corporate name. If you send the bill to U.S. Steel, I don't think you'd have to say U.S. Steel Corporation Incorporated or whatever it is. I think it was just a convenient way of saying, in fact, I noticed a number of those bills looking at them today, they just say Sagebrush Sales. Is in there. The plaintiff is Sagebrush Sales Company. It's a corporation, too. But I don't think Sagebrush Sales was suggesting by that evidence that it's not a corporation. Or that some entity other than Sagebrush Sales was paying the, was liable on the contract.
They were paid for by what check?
The evidence is not complete on that. Their testimony was that after the that it was well into the dealings between the parties that Sagebrush Sales started saving check stubs or the stubs that came with the checks. Some of them came from Strauss Investments, which is a DBA of Mr. Strauss. But I think it's an overstatement to say that I think the plaintiff did it at every statement. That everything was paid by something other than Crawford Trust Properties Incorporated. Certainly, you can't add up the checks in the evidence and draw that conclusion. And
any evidence of payment by Crawford Trust Properties Inc.
Is there evidence that they ever? I don't know of any check in evidence from it, but I don't know that it's. And I might say this, it doesn't seem to me that who pays it is of significance to the, who's liable. I mean, whether it's a contract or not, I think anybody could pay a debt. But that doesn't make the corporation the alter ego of the person who might be paying the money at. I know of no case that says that, and I know of at least one in my brief that says it doesn't make any difference. That you can, if your corporation's running short of money, you can pay its debt and still have a viable corporation. Now it seems to me,
you familiar with the Couples case out of the Dallas court recently?
Couples?
No.
I haven't seen it.
Couples. Pipe manufacturing company. About 8 or 10 corporations all wound in and out, paying each other's bills.
I don't see that one. We did not have anything like that. I think it's important to stress this. And that is the continued recognition by the plaintiff that it was dealing with a corporation. Most impressive to me are the settlement agreements. This is long down the road when it's obvious that there's going to be a problem in getting this money. And they have lawyers there. They enter into a series of agreements with escrows. Each of them starts out, whereas the contractor, Sagebrush, has allegedly performed or furnished labor or specially fabricated or furnished materials pursuant to that contract or purchase order entered into on January 18, 1974. This is the contract we're talking about right here. By and between the contractor and Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated. That's a year after they started their dealings together, 6 or 7 months after the contract in question. And Sagebrush signs this document specifically recognizing that it is a contract between Sagebrush and Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated. And about 2 months later, they did it again. There's another an agreement trying to settle all this up, and it starts out, whereas the contractor, Sagebrush, has furnished materials pursuant to that certain contract entered into January 1874 by and between the contractor and Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated. Now, the special issues, there is one other thing I would like to say before I get into the special issues specifically. I think specifically that the plaintiff has misconstrued, he laid heavy stress on it in his application for writ of error, and he stressed it again heavily in his argument, and that is that he says one of these settlement documents indicates that, recites that this obligation is a debt against Richard C. Strauss. It does not say that.
I understood it to be a conversation. Mr. Cheshire testified that Strauss admitted to meeting that he owed the money, he Strauss.
Yeah, that is something, that is, Mr. Cheshire did say that. And at that meeting, after he says Mr. Strauss said that, they entered into these contracts, which recite that the obligation is between Crawford Strauss Properties Incorporated and Sagebrush. And make what?